From the Vault, a true crime podcast, is a production of JPF Productions and Bebo Studios. All opinions stated are those of the podcast and its hosts and are not to be considered factual. Any facts related to today's case has been backed up by resources provided in the description for the podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello listeners, Jason Futch here, and I want to bring to everyone's attention a very cool true crime podcast that's out there, Crime Time Nerds, a sister podcast. It is hosted by sister-in-laws Nat and Ash as they share cold cases from their home state of Vermont. But don't let that fool you, because they also talk about cases from across the United States and around the world. As a matter of fact, I was just recently a guest on their podcast as me and my colleagues from the Fenley Creek Jane Doe Task Force discussed the case of Fenley Creek Jane Doe and her unborn child that was buried in the hills of eastern Oregon in the late 1970s. Check them out. They are awesome. You can listen to them wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in Crime Time Nerds and they pop up right there. So go ahead, check them out. Really cool podcast, and I highly encourage everyone to listen. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode from the Vault right here on Spotify, Anchor, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast and then some. I'm Jason Futch, and I'm happy to have everybody on for another episode as we talk about Septic Tank Sam, a John Doe that was found in Tofield, Alberta, Canada in 1977. Before we start talking about that case, we got a couple of updates we need to make. But I think the biggest update I need to make right now is welcoming Nick Wagler back. How you doing, man?
I'm doing wonderful. How about yourself?
Oh, man, I'm doing great. I'm glad to hear your voice again, and I'm sure the rest of the world agrees with me. How's everything going with you?
So far, so good. I'm still powering through college and with work. I'm just excited to be back behind the mic again. It's been too long.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad to have you back. Yeah, so I know while you've been away too, you've been working very diligently on the upcoming episode that you're planning to write on the Amy Mahalovic case. Now, you informed me before the show that you had some very important updates that you wanted to share with our listeners. Go ahead and share them with us.
So this came as a shock to me and to many other individuals who followed this case for years. It was announced on the 10th of this month that a new person of interest has emerged in the case, where an unnamed man who has yet to be charged, his girlfriend submitted a tip that at the time of the murder, he was not accounted for, which was out of character from what she described, and he didn't have an alibi. And furthermore, he drove a similar vehicle. He had carpet fibers that were similar to what were recovered on Amy's body. After he was interviewed by investigators in 2019, as the news report says, he did make some suspicious statements. This is a groundbreaking development, and it's been 31 years since she disappeared and was found murdered. And I'm still reeling by this announcement, because this was always a very, very important case to me. I followed it for half of my life, and now there is a chance there could be resolution. It pains me to say, but Amy's mother will never know, because she passed away, unfortunately, after Amy's death. And I think right now it's just a matter of time. Police still need to do more investigation. This individual has not been identified publicly, and we just need to let them work, in the words of James Renner, who has diligently followed this case since he was a child. As you all know, we did plan to release this episode much earlier because of how, in a combination to what's been going on with my education, my work, and all that fun stuff, the episode is going to need some tweaking and revamping because this is huge. I initially wanted to kind of focus on certain aspects of who her killer might have been, maybe the chance that there could be additional victims. And I think right now, I don't want to focus on who he was if this turns out to be the person who is responsible. What's best is to just tell her story, what happened, and the investigation that went on prior to this huge development. There hasn't been a whole lot of additional information released at this time, but I appreciate your patience, listeners. This is just something that, you know, it's hard to find words for how excited I am right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you told me the information on the Mihaljevic case, I was probably just as equally excited because that meant you are going to have to add something new to this episode that is kind of going to be in a way different from the regular narrative on the Mihaljevic case. And the fact that you also have been in contact with a special guest that you plan on having, we're not going to reveal who said special guest is just yet, but it's just amazing the work that you've put into producing and writing that episode. And when we finally get an opportunity to talk about Amy's case, I'm sure it's just going to be just as exciting and fresh as the recent reports and developments that we've been getting in the last couple of days. So we totally understand, you know, the delays and everything. We're okay with it. In fact, you know, if it means Amy finally getting some closure in this investigation, then so be it.
Absolutely.
All right. So we'll go ahead and start gearing toward talking about Septic Tank Sam. But before we do, I want to take a minute to explain to our listeners why we are talking about Septic Tank Sam now and not Taylor McAllister as we had originally planned. So, as you all know, Taylor McAllister was another case that we were going to cover in this lineup. She was murdered near Christmas Day in 2016. And, you know, it's probably one of the most graphic cases that I'm going to be covering. But unfortunately, the McAllister suffered yet another loss. And that was Taylor's older sister, Caitlin McAllister. She passed away early in February because you guys are going to be listening to this in March. And she passed away from unknown causes. And frankly, I don't think it's anyone's business, you know, what she passed away from. But we wanted to take a minute to send our condolences to Bill and Leslie, her parents, and the rest of the McAllister family and her friends on this tragic loss. And out of respect and after discussing it with the McAllisters, we're going to hold back for probably a few episodes before we start talking about Taylor, because we've also included an interview with Bill and Leslie that we're working on. And before we even do the interview, I want to make sure that they're ready to talk about the case, especially considering this difficult time. So until then, we're going to continue on with the set list and keep the McAllisters in your thoughts as they go through this. So anyways, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and get talking about Septic Tank Sam. Just remember, folks, this is a very graphic case. Maybe just as graphic as Taylor's case. I don't know. What would you think, Nick?
When I first came across Septic Tank Sam, I didn't see a whole lot of information about how he died. And as more and more research emerged from some of the other amazing contributors I've had on the Unidentified Wiki site, as well as additional research that I've done, this is a pretty unsettling murder. So that is definitely something that we should definitely alert our listeners to.
Absolutely. Because I mean, you know, to have your body sitting in a septic tank for over a year covered in quicklime, and on top of that, some of the stuff that Sam went through, this definitely has the telltale signs of torture and abuse. And yeah, and as we go along throughout the episode, you all will learn exactly what I'm talking about. So before we begin, I want to let everybody know that our show today is sponsored by Crime Watchers in Pursuit of the Missing, the Unidentified and Justice. Every case that we cover, including Septic Tank Sam's case, is on their forum board. So if you want to talk about Septic Tank Sam's case while you're listening to this episode, go to crimewatchers.net, sign up for a free account, and get involved in the conversation today. Again, that's crimewatchers.net. So Tofield, Alberta, Canada is a town of just over 1,200 residents in 1977. Just under an hour east of Edmonton, it is a fairly quiet farming community where news quickly spread if something went awry. Probably just like Rylander, yeah?
Yeah, you know, we have had a few cases that have really shocked the community over the last quarter of a century that I've lived here. And compared to Tofield, Rhinelander is much larger at about 8,000 people. At a much smaller scale, just to imagine how that would have been for, you know, a quiet rural area, this had to be something that everybody knew about, that everybody was probably concerned over and never expected.
Absolutely. Yeah, because you don't get a dead body every day in a town of under, you know, 2,000 people. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you really don't hear about that. And when you do, it brings a shock to the senses. And I'll tell you what, Nick, that is what happens on the day of April 13th of 1977. That day, Tofield resident Charlie McLeod was in need of a septic tank pump. It was needed for his new house that he was building, just a couple of miles from an old farmhouse that he owned. He realized, though, that instead of buying a new pump, he could recycle the one at his old farmhouse. And that's smart. I mean, it saves money. If the pump is still in great condition, why not? You know, he's not using it at that farmhouse anymore, so just go ahead and move the septic tank pump over to the other one. Put it to use instead of letting it sit there. So smart thinking on Mr. McLeod's part. But then after he gets to that septic tank, I'm sure he probably wished he hadn't.
Yeah, it was definitely something that I don't think anybody could have ever expected. Yeah, that would be, I would hate to just imagine what it was like for him after he went to the scene and started to take a closer look.
Absolutely. And when he arrived at the farmhouse, you know, he saw that the septic tank was covered in debris. And even though it was unusual, because you don't really cover the septic tank up with debris. You know, you really don't. It's almost unheard of. I know, like, when people have septic tanks located in, like, big fields, sometimes they'll put, like, a metal plate over it, or they'll put something to signify that it's a septic tank, so that way, you know, people are not trying to park on top of it. When you have a pile of debris on top of it, it's really uncommon, because at some point, you're going to need easy access to the septic tank if something went bad. At the same time, you know, it was the old farmhouse, so he didn't think twice about it. So he just simply removed the debris and opened up the old septic tank. And when he opened it up, you got to keep in mind, this particular septic tank was 6 feet deep. So when he opened it up, he began to fish for the pump. But as he was fishing for the pump, he comes across a sock followed by a shoe. Then he believes that there is a leg, or a foot rather, inside these articles of clothing. So he drove to town and alerted the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Tofield Detachment, and they quickly arrived to the scene. And when the officers got there, they began to look inside the tank, and they made a shocking find. Human remains that were badly decomposed. The body was rolled up in a yellow sheet with rope tied around his head and body. And when the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Crime Scene Unit arrived, they went to work to recover the body. It took investigators over 6 hours to recover the remains. And part of the recovery involved investigators removing the water by hand with ice cream pails, which took over an hour. Could you imagine having to do that?
That's honestly probably one of the most revolting jobs that you could have to do for police work. I'm sure a lot of them never imagined having to do such a thing for what they were hired for. I can't even imagine the smells and just the overall disgusting conditions of having to do that.
Exactly. It's kind of like that Star Trek quote when, you know, Bones tells Captain Kirk, "Damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a so-and-so." And then this case, it would be, damn it, Jim, I'm a cop, not a sanitation worker.
Seems like, you know, something you would see in Criminal Minds or NCIS, something that only happens on TV and not in a very small Canadian town.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you really don't see anything like this, but when you do, holy cow, like, especially in this situation right here. I mean, you find a body that's been rolled up in a yellow sheet inside a septic tank. Like, you could only imagine the horror that Mr. McLeod went through when he made that gruesome discovery, and especially when it came to light what was really inside that septic tank, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, you know, I bet he was hoping it would just be, you know, nothing, like somebody was pulling a joke and they put a couple of old clothing items in a shoe. Turns out there's much more than that. I don't think I could honestly stick around and watch the process of police officers emptying everything out and, you know, revealing that, yeah, there really was a body in there. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it is a pretty, I mean, especially the method that investigators had to go through by using ice cream pails to dump out the raw sewage that was in there only to uncover this body. I mean, there's just so much wrong in this particular scene that it's just awful. And then it just gets even darker from that point. When the body was recovered, it was sent to Edmonton for an autopsy. It was determined by the medical examiner that the man was probably of European-Canadian descent, and he also determined that the person had suffered from childhood disease based on his bones and teeth. Now, based on the position of the body in the septic tank, it was understood that the body was dropped in the tank head first. There was evidence the body was also covered in quicklime to accelerate the decomposition. Doesn't that sound familiar to you, Nick?
It definitely does, especially with the Lime Lady case in Oklahoma. Thankfully, that was resolved and she was identified as Tamara Tygaard. And yeah, that's immediately what I thought of when I heard the word quicklime. And this was, you know, 3 years before she was found. And
yes, absolutely. And, you know, but, you know, the one particular case that comes to my mind when I hear that, it's the Gacy case.
Of course. Yeah.
And the crazy thing about this, too, is that the Gacy case and Septic Tank Sam's case are very, very loosely connected. It's something that we'll explain here momentarily, because I think it's a very interesting thought, especially considering that Gacy's victims and this man were, you know, in a way disposed of in a similar fashion, although Septic Tank Sam was not buried under, you know, a couple of feet of dirt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he wasn't found in a river or in the woods. He was, you know, placed in, you know, an area that was rather undesirable for a final resting place.
Exactly. And, you know, it's crazy, too. I was listening to another podcast talking about Septic Tank Sam, and for the most part, she said that she felt like investigators could have called him something else. In a way, it's kind of a disrespectful name for a man who probably didn't want to go out like that, which I understand. But at the same time, it stands out. The name Septic Tank Sam stands out. It rolls off the tongue easier. But hopefully at some point, we won't have to call him that anymore.
Yeah, and I agree very much with that point, because you do kind of have to consider, you know, the victim and their loved ones if they're ever identified. When you think about it, that is kind of an unpleasant name to be referred to as. But at the same time, you know, it's given him a lot of uniqueness where he's easily recognized if he is mentioned somewhere. But I definitely see both sides of that story, for sure. I know if somebody found me in a septic tank, I wouldn't have really wanted to be known by that either. So, and I think most people can agree with that too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't want to be remembered that way, but you know, sometimes it might be like better than being identified as Trash Pile Eddie, or I don't know. What are some other gross places you could find a body at?
I think there's probably a very long list for sure.
Yeah, but definitely I think Septic Tank has to be on the top of the list though.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But But getting back to the examiner's notes here, the examiner had concluded, based on injuries to the body, that the person was killed by a gunshot to the head and to the chest. And the examiner also had mentioned as well that the person could have been shot numerous times, but the bullets never reached the skeleton. Because at this point, the body was so badly decomposed. I'm sure at this point, a lot of tissue has probably been degraded or gone at this point. Mm-hmm. A year in a septic tank with quicklime on your body, I mean, it does a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, this was 1977, so you know, at the same time too, some of that evidence might not have been recovered because it was probably difficult for them to get a hold of everything that was on the very bottom.
As we continue with the examiner's notes, he also makes a very gruesome note here. He also revealed that this individual had been beaten, tied up, and burned with either a butane torch or cigarettes. Based on markings that were found on the sleeves of the blue Levi's shirt that the decedent was found with, and there were also additional markings, but the specific notes to the injuries were based on marks on the Levi's shirt. And additional clothing that was found with the decedent was a gray t-shirt, blue jeans, and an imitation pair of Wallaby shoes, brown in color, possibly. And also, another thing to note here about the blue jeans that he was wearing, there was a particular cut in the pants, and it was in the groin area. It was determined that the decedent was sexually mutilated with farming shears, which is why it took investigators a month to positively identify the person as male, according to an article from the Edmonton Journal from May 21st of 1977. Now, some reports state that it took several months to get a positive gender identification on this guy. The examiner had determined that this person may have been dead possibly as long as a year. So what do we do with that information there?
For me, I definitely see this as whoever was behind his death, this was personal. Based on how he's tortured, he's burned with cigarettes or torch. And I honestly hope that the mutilation was a forensic countermeasure, essentially, to kind of prevent or delay the identification process. I really hope that this man was not alive when that happened. Just the amount of malice that is behind this guy's death. It's unsettling, but you know, it's something that I feel whoever did this had something, you know, a very strong hatred for the victim.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel about it too, because you don't just randomly do this to somebody. Serial killers, I mean, you can look at a long list of serial killers, Gacy, Manson, Bundy, Dahmer, all these different serial killers. Well, maybe to some exception, Dahmer. But in a lot of those cases, you didn't really necessarily see abuse and mutilation like this. For the most part, they got off on murder, and that was it. And then maybe they did something to the body post-mortem. In this instance, it would appear to me that they may have kept this man alive for several days before killing him.
I would agree.
For me, that's what I see here, is that they probably kept him alive for a considerable amount of time so he could feel all of this pain and then kill him. Now, that would drive me to the fact that someone had to have really hated this guy. There was some kind of motivation there that made whoever killed this guy think that he deserved this kind of punishment.
Absolutely. And if this was the work of a serial killer, I would say there would have to be similar cases like this. And to the best of my knowledge, there are not. This definitely seems like this is something that was isolated, very personal crime, rather than a serial killer trying to get off or to find surrogates for somebody who wronged him before. Or I should say them, but I definitely agree with your point that he was probably kept alive and tortured before he was killed, and he was shot to death, which shows that was a pretty instantaneous way to die, yet they still took the steps to make sure that he really did suffer before they ended his life.
Yeah, it's kind of like RoboCop. Did you ever see the original RoboCop?
I have not, but it is on my my Netflix watch list, so I'll get there.
Yeah, in the original RoboCop, Murphy, the main character, he is basically tortured before he's murdered. Not like Septic Tank Sam. In fact, I think Murphy probably got a worse death than Septic Tank here. He's mutilated by a shotgun before he's essentially put out of his misery by a shot to the head. Now, this is what I also think, too, is that I think it was one of those moments where it's like Old Yeller, put the dog out of its misery. After, you know, several days of abusing Sam here, he's basically at this point worthless to whoever was torturing him. So they decide to put him out of his misery. And they probably did it in the fashion that the examiner had mentioned, a shot to the head and a shot to the chest.
And to me, that also might suggest that there could be, you know, an instance where it could have been more than one person who participated in the crime. You know, perhaps there was at least one individual who had the personal connection, or at least the reason, the motivation to kill the victim. And there could have been someone else who kind of was, they may have been associated with Septic Tank Sam during life, but they might have been, you know, less, I guess, motivated to do the killing.
But yeah, when we talk about community here, because there was also some speculation that there was probably locals that were involved in Sam's case. But regarding the entire town of Tofield, though, they were on edge. I mean, locals talked about the find amongst friends and family, and business owners were concerned that the suspect or suspects were customers at their stores. Now, there was one particular citizen named John, I might slaughter this last name here, but John Bergen, the store manager of the local co-op Tofield, he was definitely concerned because of the manner this man was tortured. You have to remember, when you consider the fact that farming shears were used, someone in the local community, like the store manager of the farmer's co-op store, he's going to wonder, did those pair of shears come from my store? Like, it's basically like, you know, you have to sleep with one eye open. You don't know who your neighbor might be. And then you're wondering, of all of the 1,700 residents here in Tofield, who could have possibly killed Septic Tank Sam?
I think it was 1,200.
Correction, 1,200. But yeah, it just makes people think in a situation like this. And yeah, sometime after the initial investigation, investigators had bestowed upon the remains the name Septic Tank Sam. Now, this was after they were able to positively identify the remains as being male. They decided to go ahead and give him the nickname Septic Tank Sam. And as we discussed a few minutes ago, it rolls off the tongue better, but at the same time, it definitely could be considered a very questionable nickname, Septic Tank Sam. So with that being said, thankfully they did not put it on his tombstone, because I don't think he even got one, but that would have been an interesting name to just come across randomly if you're like a cemetery hunter.
Yeah, and I do feel that giving an unidentified individual a nickname, especially early on, it really does help differentiate them from, you know, the thousands out there already. Like, if somebody mentions Princess Doe, Valentine Sally, Callie Doe, a lot of people are familiar with those cases because of their nicknames. And that definitely promotes the recognition, and, you know, with more recognition, there are going to be more people talking about the case, which, if the right person is exposed to that information, it could be groundbreaking.
Exactly. And that's kind of like the thing that, you know, me and the group over at the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force are finding out, that since we've been calling her Findlay Creek Jane Doe, it rolls off the tongue nicely. It's memorable, and people are going to recognize it, especially if they lived in the area. They're like, Findlay Creek, that's just up the road. You know, that's where that Jane Doe was found. Like, stuff like that, it really definitely brings up some form of recognition or another. You know, it's, yeah, like you said, it definitely gives them some kind of quality, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So with that being said, after a while, since they couldn't come up with his actual name, they decided to go ahead and give him a funeral and bury him. So they buried him in a cemetery in Edmonton while investigators continued to look over his file and receive tips as they came in. And investigators had also attempted to locate a dentist
familiar with Sam's teeth in an effort to identify him. And in fact, over 800 dentists in Canada had been contacted, but to no avail. So at some point, a detective with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police was talking to a colleague. And so during this said conversation, the detective's colleague had brought up an article that he had read in the newspaper about bones and about how one guy in Oklahoma City was using bones to create a face. The skull of an individual, John and Jane Doe, they would use the skull and reconstruct it using clay. And essentially, this was kind of like a last-ditch effort for investigators should they end up with dead-end leads and weren't going anywhere with what they had at that moment. So the investigator on this case decided to look into that. And, well, he found a guy named Dr. Clyde Snow. So in 1979, Sam's remains were exhumed from his grave and sent to Oklahoma City to the office of Dr. Snow. Now, I wanted to take you guys back a minute here because I mentioned just a little while ago there was a very loose connection to the Gacy case in this investigation. Dr. Clyde Snow was the forensic pathologist and anthropologist who was the one that was assisting with the facial reconstructions of the John Does that were found in Gacy's basement with the help of Betty Gatliff, who was the actual forensic artist. Dr. Snow was the one who did the examinations. He made the notes, but Betty Gatliff was the artist who did the facial clay reconstructions of Gacy's victims. Now, aside from the John Wayne Gacy case, he had also worked on cases involving King Tut, President Kennedy, among others. With that being said, Dr. Snow was tasked with reconstructing the victim's face and also determining other factors based on Sam's skull. I think they were in pretty good hands here, wouldn't you think?
Most definitely, especially with Betty Pat Gatliff, she unfortunately passed away last year, but she lived a very long and successful life. You can always tell which reconstruction she's been involved with. They're very recognizable. And, you know, I was pretty sure that she had done work on this case based on how similar his reconstruction looks to other parts of her portfolio. And I think for sure with experts at the time, she was probably one of the most active and sought out forensic artists at the time, you know, in the late 70s. There are still many other unsolved cases that are still out there that you can tell she did work on that case. And she has done very, very well when some victims are later identified, especially with the Gacy victim, Bill Bundy, who the photograph of him is almost identical to the clay bust that Betty Pat Gatliff made. So I think this was a very big step for Sam's case. And it is unfortunate that the forensic art didn't provide the resolution they hoped for.
Yeah. And you know, going back to Betty Gatliff for a second here. Yeah. As you mentioned, her art is very recognizable because I noticed one of the biggest distinction is the eyes of her work, mm-hmm. the eyes that she gives her models, so to speak. And yeah, it's very recognizable. It's kind of like Ann Coy's clay art. A lot of people probably never heard that name unless you lived in the Southeast. But a lot of the clay models that were made in the mid to late 90s and early 2000s in South Georgia and most of Florida was definitely the work of Miss Coy, who was a forensic artist with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. In fact, of note was Forrest Doe. Although she kind of made him a little rough, but at the same time, she was not necessarily working with a very well-shaped skull. So, you know, she had her work cut out for her. But yeah, I mean, definitely, I wish that, you know, after Dr. Snow's work and Miss Gatliff's work, I wish that they would have been able to have some kind of resolution, but they did not. But this case, though, even though there was no resolution regarding the likeness, they were able to learn a lot more about Sam than they were during the initial examination of the skeleton with RCMP. So First and foremost, I do want to kind of touch up on the reconstruction of Sam. It took Dr. Snow with Betty Gatliff 3 days to complete a facial likeness on Sam, which would be the first reconstruction done on the remains. Now, when the reconstruction was completed, Sam's skeleton was examined. When Dr. Snow determined that the man was between 5'3" to 5'9". Now, because we may have some listeners in Canada and elsewhere, that would equate to about 168 centimeters. And he likely weighed between 145 pounds and 165 pounds. That's 70 kilograms in the metric system. He was also certain that the remains belonged to those of a male between the ages of 26 to 40 years of age, with a 50-50 range of 29 to 36. Dr. Snow also determined, based on Sam's hands, that he was likely right-handed. And another interesting fact was that Dr. Snow made a very careful observation that the man appeared to have been of indigenous descent. However, he could not say for sure, but I do remember reading in an article that was about Septic Tank Sam's case and Dr. Snow's work in an issue of the Windsor Star. He had discussed that the upper row of teeth was shaped in a specific way that is only usually shaped in indigenous persons.
Yeah, and I do actually, that reminds me of the case of Cary Graham and Francine Trimble. When an evidence box was later recovered, there was this tooth that was found. They didn't know if it necessarily was related to the case. It could have gotten mixed up. But I remember reading that after examining that randomly appearing tooth, that it came from somebody of Native descent. So it definitely does show, you know, that is an important clue if it is unique to that particular ethnicity.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting observation. But just keep in mind, too, like, you know, Dr. Snow didn't want to necessarily say for sure, because also in a very small percentage, the same style of teeth could have been found in Caucasians, but he wasn't going to necessarily make that observation because he couldn't say for sure, which, you know, even though he was pretty confident it was a person of indigenous background. But I will say this, though. See, the findings that Dr. Snow had made were way different from what the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were making in 1977. And as I mentioned, in September of 1980, the Windsor Star in Ontario had published an in-depth story on Sam and Dr. Snow and Gatliff's work on the case. I mean, it was literally a full 2 pages of information, and I really enjoyed reading it. I got to learn a lot more about, you know, Dr. Snow's process as to how he determines things. And I also got an opportunity to read a little bit more about Betty Gatliff's work and how she makes things happen. So it's a very good read. And it was in the Windsor Star that came out in September of 1980. So if you have a newspapers.com account, go check it out. It's really cool. But after Dr. Snow's observation, the remains were sent back to Edmonton and reinterred while the Mounties worked on fresh leads. And by 1988, the case had received over 500 tips, but nothing substantial in leads. And before I continue, folks, if you hear any like loud background noise, I'm in a hotel and somebody's dog decided to bark while I was recording. So there's that.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Yeah. I was like, oh my goodness, like why do that in the middle of a recording? And why do you have your damn dog with you in a hotel? Yeah. So anyways, on September 12th of 1988, sometime after Dr. Snow's observations and whatnot came to light, the Edmonton Journal ran a detailed story on Septic Tank Sam. This prompted more tips and some life to the case, but like others, the tips went cold. And rumors and stories circulated suspecting that Septic Tank Sam was not from Tofield, considering no one in the area knew him and that he may have been a farmhand somewhere outside of the Tofield area, just based on his clothing. And then other rumors circulated that he may have been a victim of gang violence in Edmonton and that his body was disposed of by someone familiar from the area. And I will say this, I could debunk that theory just based on how this man was killed. because I think if it was gangland violence, he would have been probably riddled with bullets. And I don't think he would have been tortured. Wouldn't you think?
I think to the degree and the style of torture that he experienced. I would agree with you that, you know, this was probably somebody who had a personal vendetta against the man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely somebody who was targeted, and this murder was definitely planned out. And I don't really see a gang wanting to necessarily hold him captive, torture him, and then shoot him a couple of times, and that was the end. You know, this was probably deeply personal for somebody.
Yeah, definitely. Which, you know, brings me to my next to the next part of this. You know, there was definitely a more gruesome story that was being floated around in the Tofield area and also amongst detectives, that Sam may have been killed by locals because he may have committed a brutal sexual offense, or that he may have been sleeping with someone's wife. I could see that in both theories, that, you know, well, the mutilation would definitely be a sign that, in some people's eyes anyways, this was kind of like an eye for an eye. Well, this man raped my girlfriend, or this man raped my daughter, I'm going to make sure he doesn't rape anyone ever again. And he does what he does to Sam and then kills him because he's not going to do anything anymore, taking one, you know, predator off the street. But, like, here's the thing about that, though, is that we don't know for sure if that's what he did. I mean, you know, we can't necessarily go around saying, okay, so this guy is a sex offender, this guy did some pretty nasty shit while walking the streets, and then a town decided to take vengeance on this guy, kind of like Ken Rex style in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, too, that, you know, if he was, you know, potentially having an affair with someone else's wife, I can definitely see somebody whose ego is bruised, they feel emasculated, and they're going to get revenge, and they're going to maybe view that such an act as restoring their masculinity by punishing this man, you know, taking what's his. You know, and that is, you know, it definitely, depending on the person, if they're that angry and deranged, you know, to do something like that, that is possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I definitely wouldn't rule it out. But, you know, it's just crazy because, the thing is that we can come up with all these theories, these rumors and stuff like that. You know, we can formulate an opinion, but you've listened to before the show started and elsewhere, opinions are only just that, opinions. They're not based on fact in any way. It's just speculation. And although the injuries could definitely tell a story that this was definitely a personal attack, that someone who killed this man had to have really hated his guts. When this man is identified, I'm sure we'll probably find out more about him. He might not be the saint that people might portray him as right now. Hell, in fact, I mean, I hate to say this about the dead, but maybe in fact he did deserve what he got. He may have deserved to get thrown in the septic tank. We can't make those kind of conclusions just yet. We need to identify him so that way we can see what kind of a person this man was in life. Wouldn't you agree?
Definitely. You know, you can't necessarily, you know, promote and run with this theory as such a theory as, you know, ultimately true, you know, that it's a fact when in reality we could be completely wrong. This could be something much different than what investigators believed and what contemporary sleuths today are imagining. So, you know, we kind of just have to wait and see. And after, you know, even after an identification, there might be very little information available about the victim in life. And we might just have to keep considering the unknowns and just let police do their job and do their own investigation. And when they're ready to release it, they will.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you something, too. So when I remember prior to Freddie Laster being identified, I always thought the Lake City John Doe case had to have been the work of something organized. I always thought that the person responsible for Freddie's death was probably a gang, or it was something related to a personal issue, because there was some factors to consider, including injuries around the groin area. And that was what I had thought initially. But then when you find out that it was actually a therapist who killed him, and that Freddie was actually a really nice boy, it really changed the tune of things.
Exactly. And I remember, too, with Deborah Jackson, who was known as Orange Sox for 40 years, you know, I had, you know, all these ideas of where she could have come from and what her life was like. And I even used that hypothetical story as the inspiration of something I'd written for class, for a creative writing class. And, you know, after her identification, you kind of realize this really might not have been anything like she was when she was alive. Like, you know, there's still not a whole lot of information about what her life was like before she died and before she was last seen. It's something that could be very, very different than what you or anybody else could expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, the more we learn about an unidentified person, then we can make a better judgment as to what kind of person they were. And to be quite honest, too, even when we do find out who this person was and how they lived their life, except in rare instances, we should not judge that person based on some of the choices that they made. But then, you know, you have characters like Henry Lovelace, the torso that was found in Clark County, Idaho. Years later, when Redgrave Research and the DNA Doe Project identified that torso as being an outlaw, like, holy cow, you know, it's crazy because this guy was actually a murderer, a cold-blooded murderer, murdered his wife, and on top of that, he robbed banks and stuff like that. Then at that point, maybe we might have a little room for judgment, but if we don't know the whole story, then it might be best to keep our damn mouths shut.
Exactly.
Yeah, so with that being said, whatever the case may be, Septic Tank Sam is still unidentified. And even after a forensic reconstruction by Cyril Chan in Edmonton that was done in 2000, no clues could be provided as to who he was. But his death still lingers throughout the halls of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Edmonton's Cold Case Unit, as well as the locals in the sleepy town of Tofield, and its now 2,081 residents, most who were likely not born when this case happened. And it's interesting I brought up Cyril Chan. Cyril Chan was adamant in one article I remember reading. He was adamant that his reconstruction was better than Dr. Snow's reconstruction, and he said he's never wrong. He said that in one newspaper article in the journal, he's never wrong. Now, that's just a little cocky, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I kind of have to agree, you know, especially when it is a rendering from severely decomposed remains, you don't have a lot to work with and you have to make estimations. Tissue depth is usually based on, you know, average depth for the average person. It's not always specific to that victim. And I do believe that variety in, I guess, artists behind the reconstructions can help with recognition in case one does tend to be more accurate than the other. But, you know, it's, you definitely can't really have that sort of attitude for sure. That's definitely off-putting. It quite honestly kind of even makes the Cyril Chan seem a little less credible just because of that underlying arrogance. And you know, it's still been, you know, 21 years since that reconstruction was made. And, you know, there still hasn't been any identification yet.
Because, I mean, we didn't see Dr. Snow going around saying, well, I worked on these high profile cases and I know I'm right because they are high profile. I worked on Gacy's victims and I made sure they were blah, 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 blah. You know, he could have went on and went on. But, you know, what I learned about Dr. Snow was he was a very humble man all the way to the very end. I mean, he was very admired and he was very respectful of his work. And I'm not taking anything away from Dr. Chan here because I'm sure, you know, he does do an amazing job. I'm sure he does amazing work. But to be super confident about his reconstruction on Septic Tank Sam, he should probably err to the side of caution on that one, because then when it comes time, you know, that he's identified and he looks nothing like Dr. Chan's reconstruction, then, well, he might get a little butthurt by that.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, a lot of well-respected forensic artists still, you know, a lot of times, you know, once that real life photo of the victim is released, sometimes it doesn't bear a resemblance to the work of, you know, an internationally respected artist. So, you know, just because you've worked a lot of cases, just because you've gone through a lot of training, it doesn't always mean you're going to be right 100% of the time with 100% of the details. And you always do kind of have to consider that, especially with skeletal or deteriorated remains, that it's an approximation. It might only just resemble the living person in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that, because you got to understand that we don't know what that person looked like in life prior to their death. I mean, especially when we consider the fact that we've never seen a photo of this person except when they're in a, you know, dormant dead state. We've never seen an actual live photo of them, because the difference between a morgue photo and a living photo are definitely like night and day. The eyes relax a little more differently than, let's say, someone who is alive. So there's a lot of differences there. And for the most part, you're not going to get it right most of the time. People have to understand that these reconstructions are not made to look exactly like that person. It's supposed to look similar to that person. Similar and exact are completely different. So that's why people say it's only for identification purposes only. If they look somewhat familiar to you, submit a tip, because that might actually be the person you're thinking of. But yeah, for the most part, they're not going to look like the reconstruction unless the forensic artist is very good. And there's been quite a few very good forensic artists that have been able to get it right on the money.
And I have seen other instances where somebody is in recognizable condition and they're still made to look generic because they have to be open for interpretation. I do, and as I've mentioned before, I do believe that if somebody is recognizable enough and they haven't sustained a lot of trauma or a particularly excruciating death, sometimes if there is something distinctive, that needs to be included in a reconstruction. But in Sam's case, he was far too deteriorated to have any hopes of being physically recognizable.
But yeah, so with that being said, we have to always keep that in mind when we observe a forensic artist's interpretation of the victim. So, and that's where we're at. There's really been no hard leads or no evidence in Septic Tank Sam's case. There's really been nothing that's been able to tie him to a name or to any suspects. Yeah, I mean, but at least there's DNA in this case, and they've been able to possibly use that to their advantage, because now Canada actually has a similar system, kind of like NamUs in that country now. So hopefully one day it will match up with a missing person. Then we can find out what really happened in this case. If you remember a guy similar to build Sam's looks, stuff like that, we urge you to contact the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's Tofield Detachment. Their phone number is 780-662-3353. Again, that's 780-662-3353. And reference case number 77-001-38. So how about it? What did you think about today's episode, Nick?
I'm glad it went as smoothly as it did. It was great to be back and to, you know, give my two cents on such cases. And this was definitely an interesting conversation. And hopefully, you know, what we're putting out there today could hopefully add to the attention his case could get. I'm really optimistic about what could be done in the future, such as, you know, isotopic analysis or even genealogy. And even if they decide to, you know, give him a new reconstruction, I know the New York Academy of Art just recently did a bunch of work on British Columbia cases. It's been over 20 years since Septic Tank Sam had a fresh look on his skull. So another artist's perspective of how he might have looked could be the key to recognition.
Yeah, I completely agree. But on that, yeah, I think that pretty much wraps up Septic Tank Sam's case. So I ask our listeners to join us next week as we talk about Reet Gjervetson. Now, Reet Gjervetson's case is a very interesting one, because I've always found before her identification, she was known as Jane Doe 59, right?
Yep. And I know other people, based on witness statements, they always assumed her name was Sherry, which I can maybe see like being, you know, misinterpreted as that. I mean, her real name was Reet, of course, but that kind of also helped keep her having, or that kind of did bring some recognition to her case, because she was known by a potential first name, which of course wasn't the reality. But yeah, you know, I still remember when I I was reading about her case, and then I saw her name has disappeared, and you know, a few months later it was announced that a match was made after almost 50 years. So
yeah, and my theory prior to her identification was I always thought she was a Manson victim just because of her position, you know, on Mulholland Drive, and she was only like not even 5 miles away from where the triple homicide occurred with Sharon Tate and company. Like, you know, it's a really interesting case, especially when you tie in a possible Manson connection. But that was a theory that investigators debunked. But I always thought that, and in a way, I kind of still do as well, even though now that we know who she is, it's been largely ruled out. In the back of my head, I've always considered this to be a Manson homicide. But even if she wasn't killed by Charles Manson's clan, I always felt like she may have been in a way involved with the Manson family, if you know what I mean.
I mean, yeah, that's, you can't really, I guess, make a conclusive theory because it's been so long. One thing I also do want to add about Reed is that after she was identified and they started circulating more images of her, there's a few of her that I kind of always thought she kind of did resemble Sharon Tate too, especially with some color photos of her. It looks like she was maybe modeling or something. She's got her long reddish hair, very large eyes. And yeah, I guess it is kind of eerie. I think she does resemble Sharon Tate. So that's, that is kind of something that's unique.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is I noticed, you know, with Manson, and I know we'll probably touch up on this next week, but like with Manson, I noticed that he had a particular type of woman he was like aiming for, and it was usually kind of like brunettes or strawberry blonde haired women, skinny women that, you know, resembled 18 to like 25, stuff like that. He had a type. I'm just going to put it like that. He had a type, and Reed fits into that type.
And who knows? I know she came from Canada and trying to, you know, figure out a new way to start a new life as a free spirit. And who knows what she could have gotten into.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, another thing too, I kind of also thought about too, is, I mean, and this is one that I've kind of come up with as well, that if it wasn't Manson, is it possible she crossed paths with Rodney Alcala?
Honestly, who knows? I mean, this was 1969. And I think for me, I've always felt that because of how brutal her murder was, she was stabbed 150 times. I feel like it's kind of inconsistent with maybe what Alcala did. And I kind of do have the opinion that this was a crime of passion, that somebody who knew Reed probably killed her, in my opinion, just based on that level of violence. But you never know. A lot of serial killers are unpredictable, and sometimes they stray from their modus operandi.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, 150 times, that's overkill. And there's a lot of cases out there that have overkill. In fact, when I was doing season one of True Cold Case Files, we had a particular case. It was the Dorothy Blanchard Thomas homicide. She was stabbed over 50 times, and she was left to die in the bathroom of her work. And her body was found by a Coca-Cola delivery driver. So like it, you know, it happens. And there's a lot of documented cases involving overkill. So yeah, it's a lot that we're going to talk about. I know we just spent about 10 minutes talking about it, but we're going to be covering Reed's case. I'm pretty excited to cover it. We've got a lot to talk about. Yeah, so just join us next week on our next episode of From the Vault. We'll talk about that. And then before we go, I want to thank Zach Bebo over in Bebo Studios and our sponsors, Crime Watchers and Crime Time Nerds, for helping us out today. Y'all have been wonderful. So again, join us for our next episode on Reed Gervetson, and we'll go from there. Nick, thank you for joining me on another episode of From the Vault.
I was glad to be here. Thanks for having me, and thanks for not firing me when I needed a break.
No worries, buddy. I mean, okay. Hell, we all do the shit, so yeah. It's all good. So, yeah, other than that, ladies and gentlemen, we will see you on the next episode of From the Vault.
This episode of From the Vault is sponsored by Crime Watchers in pursuit of the missing, the unidentified, and justice. Each year, thousands of cases are reported throughout the United States involving missing individuals, people who are victims of homicide, and random bodies that are found throughout the country that end up not having a name months, maybe even years later. CrimeWatchers.net is the perfect place to talk about these kind of cases, because if we continue to talk about them, that means that they have not been forgotten, that justice could soon prevail in their cases. And if we don't talk about them, perhaps they may fade like a distant memory, and they may never see justice ever. That's why we continue to talk about some of these cold cases, including the one that you're going to be listening to today. That's why I implore you, go to crimewatchers.net, sign up for a free account, and get started on the conversation, because perhaps you can make a difference today. That's www.crimewatchers.net.